Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Jill Robbins, Bruce Albert, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will have the next part in our series on America's presidents. But first, everyone, including members of Congress and Native American tribes, wants fewer wild horses on Western lands and tribal reservations. But there is little agreement on how the number should be reduced. The wild horses come from horses that were brought to America from Spain in the 16th century. By 1971, the number of wild horses had dropped sharply, so Congress passed a law to save them. Since then, the number of wild horses has increased 3 times in size. Experts predict there will be 115,000 wild horses by 2020. An average adult wild horse eats more than 2.5 kilograms of grass and drinks 75 liters of water a day. As a result, non-native plants begin growing in the affected areas. The horses' actions have also caused soil erosion around water sources, threatening water quality. Jillian Lyons is a wildlife expert at the Humane Society of the United States. She said, originally, when the 1971 Act passed, it allowed the Bureau of Land Management to destroy healthy horses if populations grew too large. Since 1994, except for 1 year, the BLM has been prevented from destroying wild horses. The agency now captures and places them in holding facilities. A few horses are adopted, but not many. It costs about $50 million a year to care for the captured animals. President Donald Trump wants to cut the BLM budget by $10 million in 2018. If Congress approves the plan, the BLM would have to find other ways to manage horse populations. They're going to do that in a couple of ways, said Lyons. One is reducing any use of fertility control, which they use barely any of now. And the other way is by getting rid of horses in holding facilities. Recently, a House committee voted to permit the BLM to kill the horses. But a Senate committee voted against another bill that would lift the ban on horse killing. Native American tribes have struggled with the problem for years. Some support capturing the animals, but others, including leaders of the tribes, say the animals should be treated well and not killed. The Northwest Tribal Horse Coalition is made up of 5 small groups and tribes in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. It says, in the short term, controlling the number of wild horse births will not stop overgrazing. It supports the slaughter of horses at humane facilities. An estimated 48,000 wild horses live on the Navajo Nation's 7,000 square kilometers in Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico. Duane Chili Yazzie is the president of the nation in Shiprock. Yazzie has started a horse capture program he considers more humane. The program would euthanize sick and old wild horses and sterilize healthy ones before returning them to the wild. He is also looking to train them as farm animals.
In 1996, the United States Congress passed the Communications Decency Act to protect minors from pornography over the Internet. The law also protects website owners from being held responsible for users' opinions or comments on their pages. In 2016, two women brought a lawsuit against the website Backpage.com. They said that as teenagers, they were bought and sold for sex on Backpage.com. In the lawsuit, one of the women said her pimp chose to run ads on Backpage because he said they could avoid getting caught. He also told her Backpage.com would make him the most money, the lawsuit said. The federal court in Massachusetts said that the website Backpage.com had made sex trafficking easier. But the court also said the Communications Decency Act prevented the court from taking the sex ads down from the website.
Now 25 senators and over 100 members of the House of Representatives are proposing to change that law. Senator Rob Portman is a Republican from Ohio and the lead sponsor of the bill. He said it was never the intention of the CDA to allow websites to run advertisements for sex with underage children. Imagine, if you will, that your daughter is missing. You do everything you can to find her. Finally, you see her picture on the internet, and she is being sold for sex. That may sound like a horror movie to you, but it is very real, Portman said. Portman said the court in Massachusetts found Backpage had acted immorally. But the court decided it could not stop the website from running sex ads unless Congress changed the 1996 law. That is who we are, Portman said. We are the legislators. The Court of Appeals said, Congress, do your job.
Senator Heidi Heitkamp is a Democrat from North Dakota and a co-sponsor of Portman's bill. She said, she finds it disgusting that a law passed by Congress is being used to protect human trafficking. Portman and other sponsors of the bill are hoping a recent movie, I Am Jane Doe, will bring more information about the issue of human trafficking to the public. It tells the stories of young women victimized by human trafficking and their efforts, along with their parents, to stop websites from advertising sex with underage children. Backpage did not comment on the new Senate bill. But in a court document last month, Backpage asked another federal court to stop an investigation of its advertising by Missouri Attorney General Josh Hawley. It said, Hawley should know courts have blocked every effort to shut down websites. The company's lawyers also said the company works with law enforcement when requested to help investigations into sex trafficking. If it is stopped from running such ads, others would step in and not act as responsibly as Backpage, the company said. Hawley said his investigation would continue. He said, it is clear Backpage knows traffickers are using its website to sell sex with underage children. And Backpage wants to keep making money from sex trafficking, Hawley said. A 2017 U.S. Senate report said Backpage reportedly receives 80% of its money from sex advertising in the United States.
Michael Beckerman is president of the Internet Association. The association represents large Internet companies such as Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Twitter. Beckerman said association members regularly work with law enforcement to stop sex trafficking. But he said the new Senate bill goes too far. It will lead to unfair actions against internet companies and will not help the fight to stop human trafficking, Beckerman said. Portman said such criticism is false. The new bill would only take away protection from material on websites that assist or support people violating federal sex trafficking laws, Portman said. He said the bill protects internet freedom. What it will do, Portman said, is help children victimized by sex trafficking.
A report last month by the State Department said holding human traffickers responsible for their actions is difficult. It said that there were fewer than 10,000 convictions for trafficking worldwide in 2016. But it noted estimates of the number of victims of human trafficking remain in the tens of millions. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Bruce Alpert.
For thousands of years, humans have used yeast for making bread and alcoholic drinks, such as beer. But scientists are now constructing synthetic yeast that can do more than make a sandwich or a drink. The synthetic yeast can be used for medicines, vaccines, and biofuels, among other things. So, how does it work? Yeast, like humans, are living organisms with DNA. DNA is short for deoxyribonucleic acid. On long strings, it carries the genetic instructions used in the growth, functioning, and reproduction of all living things. Modern science allows researchers to cut and move around the four biological compounds that make up DNA. The compounds are known by the letters A, C, G, and T. The yeast genome, or its genetic material map, has more than 10 million of these DNA letters. But that is nothing compared to us. Humans have about 3 billion. Scientists have long been able to make changes in the DNA code. But now some scientists are doing something different. When you walk into Jeff Buca's lab, it smells like bread rising. But his team is not making homemade dough. Instead, they are changing the order of genes in yeast cells. Buca manages a team of 11 labs on 4 continents. He spoke to VOA Learning English about this project.
What we're doing basically is writing that DNA, and we also modify it along the way. So we sort of redesign it on a computer, and then it's that modified DNA that we actually put into cells. We swap it in place of the DNA that's already there.
So far, the scientists have constructed and replaced 6 of yeast's 16 chromosomes. The new chromosomes have all worked well. Yeast is already used to produce many other valuable compounds, such as medicines, vaccines, and biofuels. By making synthetic yeast, researchers could make different combinations used for different jobs. For example, one combination may be better for making biofuel and another for making medicine. These compounds could then be made in large industrial amounts. Synthetic yeast could also be used to make bioplastic, a material that, unlike plastic made from petroleum, would be biodegradable. Using this material would help reduce pollution. Buca says the possible uses for yeast are limited only by one's imagination.
They can be programmed through DNA writing to produce really an almost limitless range of products in terms of molecules or chemical compounds that can replace things that we currently make from petroleum or other sources, and as well as some new materials that don't even exist today.
So far, scientists have engineered yeast to produce bright colors. The yeast can make artwork, and in the future, may even be used to paint a house. But to be clear, Buca says, his teams are not creating new life.
No one's ever created life out of non-living material. All of the experiments we do start with pre-existing living cells, and we introduce modified DNA into it. So that's actually a common misunderstanding, that we're creating life. We are not creating life.
However, redesigning DNA worries some people. Lori Zoloth is a bioethicist at Northwestern University. She told the Associated Press that she is concerned about making organisms with properties we cannot fully know. She said the work would concern people who believe creating life from scratch would give humans power they should not have. It is not only a science project, she wrote to AP. It is an ethical and moral and theological proposal of significant proportions. Buca says he does not think his team is doing anything dangerous. He says he and other scientists always look at the risks, especially when it comes to food safety or when researchers engineer viruses. Buca says safety regulations help people who want to work in those areas. Other researchers experimenting with DNA are waiting to see the results of this yeast work. June Medford is with the University of Colorado.
I paid very careful attention to when they say, here are the lessons learned, because if they can't do it in a simple thing like yeast, I will never be able to do it in a plant.
But Medford and other DNA researchers will have to wait. Buca needs at least another year to finish his pioneering project. I'm Ann Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Benjamin Harrison. His family name may sound familiar. That is because he was the grandson of President William Henry Harrison. That situation is unique in U.S. history so far. Harrison played an unusually active role as president at a time when most chief executives saw themselves as simply administrators. As a result, American writer and intellectual Henry Adams said, Harrison was the best president since Lincoln. But most Americans remember little about him, except his connection to the previous President Harrison, who himself died after only a month in office. Benjamin Harrison grew up on a farm in the Midwestern state of Ohio as one of eight children. His grandfather was not the only famous political Harrison. His great-grandfather signed the Declaration of Independence, and his father had been a congressman. Young Benjamin Harrison respected these men and believed he had a role to play in history, too. He received a good education, and even outside of school, he read many books. His hard work and intelligence carried him to Miami University in Ohio, and then to a career as a lawyer. Along the way, he married a woman he had known since he was a teenager, Carolyn Lavinia Scott. The couple settled in another Midwestern city, Indianapolis, Indiana, and had a son and daughter. Over time, Harrison steadily built a career as a public official. But his political path was interrupted by the American Civil War. Harrison rose to the rank of general in the Union Army. He fought under General William T. Sherman and was one of the first soldiers to enter Atlanta, Georgia, after the city surrendered. Reports say that Harrison was an excellent soldier, but he did not enjoy fighting or find war romantic. After the war, he returned home to Indiana and continued his legal and political career. In 1881, he was elected to the U.S. Senate. But 6 years later, he lost his seat when Democrats came to power in his state. Harrison's loss of his Senate seat soon turned to a victory. The Republican Party nominated him as their candidate to run against Grover Cleveland in the 1888 presidential election. Cleveland's economic policies had become unpopular, and Republicans worked hard to support their candidate. They succeeded. Although Cleveland won the popular vote, Harrison won the Electoral College. In 1889, he followed his grandfather's footsteps all the way to the White House. Harrison's election was a major victory for his Republican Party. In addition to winning the White House, Republicans gained seats in the House of Representatives, held a majority in the Senate, and appointed several Republican justices to the Supreme Court. Harrison and other Republican lawmakers used their power to take action on issues at home and internationally. One act was to preserve forests. Harrison identified 17 protected natural areas and helped create Yosemite National Park in California. His government also established Ellis Island in New York to make immigration to the U.S. a more orderly process. Internationally, Harrison's administration sought to build ties with Latin American countries. His government established what would, in time, become the Organization of American States. His administration also increased the United States' global trade, as well as the country's navy. But, for the most part, the most pressing issues of the day were economic. The federal government at that time had an unusually large surplus. Some argued that the surplus was hurting business. In answer, Harrison's government placed a high protective tariff on imported goods. The legislation was known as the McKinley Tariff of 1890. Officials also aimed to limit the power of large corporations to control important markets in the U.S. Finally, they agreed to require the government to buy silver to use as currency. These actions pleased some of his supporters, but they may have contributed to the severe economic depression that followed Harrison's term. And in general, voters disapproved of the amount of money Republican lawmakers were spending. Although the country was at peace, the 51st Congress appropriated $1 billion. At the midterm elections, many lawmakers paid for all the spending with their seats. 2 years later, voters turned Harrison out of the White House, too. They returned Grover Cleveland to the presidency. Harrison did not express much disappointment. He had worked hard to become president like his grandfather, but he found he did not like being the chief executive. He said, when he left the White House, it was like being released from prison. Among U.S. presidents, Harrison does not have one of the most dramatic biographies. The facts of his life show an intelligent, disciplined man who tried to live by his beliefs. But he was not considered passionate about many things, except perhaps his enjoyment of nature. And he did not have an easy way with people. Even his staff called him the human iceberg, because he could be aloof and act coldly toward people. Yet Harrison's family brought some warmth to his administration. His wife, Carolyn, was known to be a lively, social person. She was the first to install a Christmas tree in the White House. Some of Harrison's grandchildren also lived in the White House. Harrison permitted them to play on the grounds with their pet animals. During Harrison's term, the family kept a goat, which the children called Old Whiskers. Harrison's time in the White House saw sorrow, too. Toward the end of her husband's term, the First Lady became seriously ill with tuberculosis. For months, Benjamin Harrison divided his attention between his wife and his job, and yet in the end lost both. After his term as president ended, Harrison returned to his home in Indianapolis. He did some work as a teacher and lawyer and kept a good public image in his community. He also remarried. His second wife was a widow herself, as well as his first wife's niece. He and Mary Scott Lord Dimmick Harrison had a daughter together. The child was only 4 when Harrison died from pneumonia at age 67. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.